Welcome to this event. It's Equilibrium's first face-to-face meeting since the start of the pandemic. Wow. We're here to discuss the influence of women in making cities. And we have framed this as a conversation rather than as a presentation with Q&A. And so I feel very privileged to be sitting here, not just with a room full of really interesting and clever people, but also with four amazing and influential players in city making who've each agreed to contribute a 5-minute provocation to get the conversation moving. But more of that later. We have, I would like to speak to our hosts for the evening, Grimshaw. I'd like to thank you for a truly splendid venue. We always enjoy being here. So a big thank you to you for your generosity and your hospitality. Really lovely to be here. My name is Caroline Cole, and I had the pleasure of founding the Equilibrium Network some 5 years ago with an amazing steering group of 17 other senior women from across the industry, developing it to what it is today. We are a multidisciplinary network, soon to go international, which now has between 400 and 500 members. I'm delighted to say both men and women, although we seem to be rather represented by the fairer sex today. And we include architects, engineers, landscape architects, contractors, surveyors, policymakers, and urbanists, as well as those working in client organizations, in academia, and in institutes. The only thing we ask of people in our network is that they strive to be influential in the work they do and to actively help achieve our aim. So our aim has developed over the years. Now, originally we had two objectives: addressing the attrition rate of women working within our industry and increasing the number of women at the top of organizations that create and shape the built environment. In other words, to increase the representation of women in positions of influence and in decision-making. Relatively recently, we've subtly redefined this aim to enable women to have an equal influence in the design and delivery of the built environment. And while our two initial objectives remain pertinent as ever, to help achieve this broader aim, we've added three more objectives: creating an international network, influencing the industry to deliver diversity and inclusion with a particular emphasis on women, promoting the needs, preferences, and aspirations of women in the design of our built environment. Now, in support of our objectives, we undertake research, we develop strategic advice, and we run occasional events like this one. A first and important step in achieving our redefined aims was helping to shape and now to be part of a successful consortium which secured funding from the European Union's Horizon 2020 project for an amazing project called Diversity, D-I-V, and then A-I-R, and then City. Diversity, Air, and City. This is an ambitious project that aims to harness the power of diversity and inclusion to achieve climate neutral cities, shifting the urban paradigm by valuing human diversity as a resource to help define models for culturally driven green cities. Diversity, following Audre Lorde's lead, recognizes, accepts, and celebrates differences, and aims to turn them into a true asset and a catalyst for change. In our case, to tackle the emergency of air pollution and climate change through a set of nature-based interventions that create innovative, sustainable, healthy, and robust urban areas. It is our role as EQN, to ensure that women's voices are both influential within the consortium itself and reflecting the outputs that the consortium comes up with. Equilibrium Network was strongly involved in helping to define diversity's strategic aims. Funding was secured in September 2021, and in the first 10 months, we've been helping to frame the working methodologies and deliverables of this important project, ensuring that gender diversity remains ever present in our work. And I'm delighted to welcome some of our colleagues in the consortium here today, and in particular, Daniela Melandri, the consortium leader, and Equilibrium steering group member. And I think it would be quite nice to Daniela. Hello. The consortium comprises 26 players from across Europe, including five cities that will be home to the interventions that result from our work. They are across Europe. We have Aarhus in Denmark, Bucharest in Romania, Castellón in Spain, Orvieto in Italy, and Potsdam in Germany. Our work to date has been led by three of our steering group members, Magali Thompson, Karen Rogers, and Sasha Kostanovich, who you'll be hearing from a little bit later. As the project moves forward, and in some ways, this is really important, pertinent to today's topic, we will be looking to ensure that people on the ground delivering diversity include women, not just in the research and the gathering of data and in the doing, but also in the strategic development and the decision-making across the professions and in the client organizations within the cities. And to this end, we will be extending the EQN network to include a European network. How we do this will be defined over the coming months, and we will be looking to our UK-based network and our colleagues within the Diversity Consortium to help us make connections with fellow professionals and with strategic partners. We will also be looking to recruit someone to help make this aspiration a reality. So if any of you would like to know more, do please let me know. So to today's conversation. I had been hoping at this stage to hand over to Pam Alexander to chair the session. Sadly, like so many others at the moment, Pam has succumbed to COVID, actually for the third time. So we have to wish her a very speedy recovery. We will start with the 5-minute provocations that I mentioned earlier. And then following the thoughts from our panel here, we will have a conversation with everyone. And depending on the energy in the room, we'll keep going for maybe an hour, see how we get on. But what's quite important, we think, is to allow people to have time to network and to enjoy each other's company, which after all has been something that we haven't all been able to do for so long. We want to keep the conversation upbeat. Yes, feel free to make observations and to tell outrageous anecdotes, but do so with a view to coming up with practical and positive solutions. We're not here to whinge, we're here to be proactive. So, moving across to the people who are going to start this whole thing going. We start with Selina Mason, Director of Master Planning at Lendlease, an organization that has a number of women in senior roles, and it will be interesting to hear how this has affected their business. We'll then hear from Lily Mattson, Chief Safety, Health and Environmental Officer at TfL. Oh, hang on a minute. What I might just do, there you go. Tells you who they all are. And Lily works to create a safer, healthier and greener transport network and she previously delivered the current mayor's transport strategy for the city, setting out a vision for transport in London to 2040. She's also a board member of the Environmental Agency. Through her role, Lily has been made acutely aware of how different people use transport networks, and it will be interesting to hear how decisions are made about meeting these diverse needs. We'll then hear from Martin Evans, Creative Director at UNI, a specialist mixed-use regeneration developer that is now part of the Landsec Group. And it will be interesting to hear how, as a client and patron, his team is able to deliver diverse thinking on their projects. And we will conclude with Sasha Kostanovic, Building Services Engineer, Low Carbon Design Specialist, founder of MSTEP and a member of the EQN Steering Group, currently working on the diversity project, which I mentioned already. So, if I may, I'll pass over then to Selina. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Caroline. If you want to make a difference, be a client. That's my provocation. Having started life as an architect, probably more years ago than I would care to let you know, I think I realized very early on that operating within a red line was really tough, operating within a budget, extremely difficult, operating within a team mostly dominated by men and conversations that were not for me, but I was just there to draw. Not easy to make a difference. And yet, if you want to make a difference, what better place than in the built environment? I mean, the impact you can have is quite is substantial. So I'm very, very glad that I sort of recognized fairly early on that I needed to sort of find a more expansive horizon and a canvas that was a bit bigger. We can talk about that later. But in terms of what I want to talk about today, I mean, Lendlease, I think, has been at the forefront of championing certainly women and more recently diversity in our industry for quite some time now, with some success, but it's not all success along, you know, it's not that easy, to be fair. But I think post-COVID, it's really, I think we've all recognized that the built environment has had, it's demonstrably has a different impact on different parts of our society. And the city often imposes these microaggressions on people in very, very different ways. If you're not white, male, and middle class, your world is different and you face different experiences. And I think people are now more broadly starting to recognize that for what it is and starting to recognize, how do you make a difference within that context? You obviously need to have diverse people dealing with it, designing it, operating it, looking after it. So I think Lendlease is kind of on the journey there. And it's fair to say that we do have a lot of women in senior roles. My boss, Beck Seeley, she's managing director of development in Europe. So she's responsible for our £30 billion European pipeline. Pretty phenomenal. She's amazing. She's a lot younger than me, which is always, I've always had younger bosses. I think that's another thing about being an architect. It takes so bloody long to be an architect that by the time you actually think, I'm not going to be an architect, all your bosses are a lot younger. So it's interesting to look. I had a quick look at the pay gap information that Lendlease publishes. You can look at it online. It's there. And we're basically the mean, the gap is 22%, which I think is kind of better than many. It's still not quite good enough. And still more men in the business get bonuses than women, largely because most of the men are very, very senior and they get shares. So that makes the bonuses sort of imbalanced there. And 58% of our workforce in the lowest quartile are women versus 21% in the top quartile that are women. But there's a big cohort in the middle that are sort of, you can see, because we've been measuring this now for nearly 10 years, they're working their way up, you know, so we're starting to see the dividend of that. And I think that that's becoming clear in the way that we're operating. And so we are seeing, I think there's a general recognition diverse teams are high performing, and we've got the evidence to suggest that. I think I don't think that Lendlease, if there weren't so many women in high in senior positions in loneliness. I don't think we would have invested in the loneliness lab a few years ago, which was looking at how could we design places that actually actively dealt with loneliness and created places where you met your neighbor and where you can make connections. I don't think we would have invested in the urban health toolkit for our staff teams that can help them understand how to deliver better, healthier places, not just physical health, but also mental health. I don't think that Elephant Park would have looked the way it is. And I don't think that many of the small businesses that are now operating Elephant Park, many of them run by local women, I don't think that would have been the same without quite so many women. And we certainly wouldn't have been doing unconscious bias training when you first joined the company, which I was really astounded by when I first joined 5 years ago. And biggest fact, every project that we won, Euston, Thamesmead, Birmingham, High Road West, £30 billion of pipeline, women led those teams, usually with men on the other side of the table. And I think that's to me really indicative that if you have got a diverse team, if you do actively promote and invest in diversity, we're not there yet. We need to get better and better and better, but it does create high performing teams. It does make a difference. And certainly architects out there, be a client. You can make a difference.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Selina. So if I can pass over now to Lily.
Yeah, thank you. Good evening, everyone. Lovely to be here. So I thought I would just use my introductory words to look at this from two ways. One, in my role within Transport for London, it's about how we think about making cities for women. And then I'll think about women making cities. So two perspectives. I mean, in a city, it's obvious thing to say, but you know, London's a very large city, 8.5 million or more people. Half of those are women. 18 million trips a day in aggregate, so 9 million each. But there's no doubt about it, transport is a man's world, and has been ever since Brunel built bridges and Stevenson built the first rocket, and well, that's a train, by the way, and Henry Ford built the car. So it really does shape the way we design and invest in transport. And I think the legacy of that is very long indeed. And if we think about what that means in terms of how people travel in London, more men use the railways, more men use the underground, women use the bus more, women walk more. And that's very clear. It reflects obviously socioeconomic status, it reflects where people are traveling to, it reflects affordability, but it has a sort of knock-on effect in terms of the fact that those, you know, running buses and delivering walking schemes is the less glamorous, the slower end of the transport market, less sexy, less ribbons to cut. Probably wouldn't have got the Queen to open our latest bus route, but she obviously does rock up to launch the Elizabeth line. So, you know, there is something in there about the fascination with the big engineering schemes. And they tend to be designed still by men. It also, I would say, extends to private transport too. If you look at how women travel in London, more women are car passengers than car drivers. Men are three times more likely to cycle. So these trends are there, but what do they actually mean in terms of my role, our role in shaping the cities? There are things that we can explicitly begin to do. So in the transport strategy that I set out, we put in place the healthy streets approach, which puts in place metrics and ways of assessing a street and the qualities and the benefits it delivers. It's gaining a lot of ground now within London and changing the way we see our city street space. The roads and streets in London are represent 80% of the public space of London. So if we can get the streets right, we can get an awful lot right for London in terms of its public space. There's other more explicit policies. So there's a qualities impacts assessment. You know, that's a provocation to you. Do you think they make any difference in terms of the schemes you design? I also know in cities like Vienna, they've come forward with gender focused planning guidance, really interesting ways where they've even talked about designing the city block on a shorter distance to make it more friendly for women walking with children. We're not doing all of those things that we probably need to do. And I think the result is that you don't necessarily see all the journeys that you should see. One of the things is that journeys that don't happen never get measured. So if we don't get things right, it's very hard to know what isn't going right to in the first place. And I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. Just to talk about the second element about women making cities. Clearly, I think there, you know, if I look, I've been at Transport for London for about 15 years. There has been a really steady change of women having more influence. I would say one of the biggest, most important things that made that change was that when Sadiq Khan was made mayor, he changed the board of the organization and made it 50% women. In fact, it's slightly more than 50% women on the board. That's had a fundamental change in terms of how the organization thinks about itself. I'm in the executive team, so one of eight people running the organization. I am, however, only one of two women on that that group. But exactly as Celine is saying, actually, there is this amazing cohort of people now coming through in slightly less senior roles, but they are really just knocking on the door now, who I think will change things. But overall, as I said at the beginning, it's still quite a male-dominated world. In TfL, there's only 25 or 24%. Are women actually. So it's if you think about that, that's 75% men in an organization. That's a very male dominated organization. And the pay gap reflects that. So the pay gap is exactly the same as what you're saying. It's about 22%. And you know, what I see my role is apart from my day job, which is around safety, health and environment, is to constantly sort of antagonize on this and to push this. And I think one of the most interesting statistics I heard of late was provided by London Travel Watch, who were surveying Londoners and surveying women in particular about their travel. And if you think that transport's meant to be enabler, it's not meant to be something you talk about in cities, it should just be there to make cities live and thrive. Their research was showing that 48% of women stop traveling at certain times due to safety. That's 48%, that's nearly half. So that's nearly half of half. That's a lot of people not making journeys in London because they're worried about safety issues. So if nothing else, it's plain commercial sense that we address this properly. And if you think about it, what a city would look like, what the vitality would look like, what the economic benefits would look like if you unlocked those 48% of journeys, I think it'd be amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Lily. Really interesting. So pass on now to Martin.
Caroline, hello, everybody. I'm very, very happy to be sitting up here this evening. I signed a pledge a little while ago that I would not sit on a panel unless it was 50% men and women. And I'm very happy to not have done that this evening, to have broken the rule this evening. I'm going to talk from a very personal perspective. I discussed with Caroline yesterday what I could bring to this conversation. I started my career, spent the first 15 years, actually nearly 20 years of my career, working in businesses that were almost wholly female. In my first job, which lasted about 8 years, I was the only man in a company of about 50 women. And then I went to work at the Body Shop for Anita Roddick, and I worked very closely with her. And even though that was I don't know what the statistic there was, but it was most definitely the predominance of women on the staff of that company, and a company that was in business predominantly to serve female customers. And so I grew up in the beginning part of my career, not really understanding that there was any other way to work in a workplace than to be in a very female dominated place. And it was, and I can only say that that was an incredibly rich beginning to my career. And when I left that job and went to work in New York and went to a relatively ordinary workplace where women were most definitely in the minority, it was like a slap in the face. I didn't quite expect it. Now, of course, I work in the property industry, which, you know, is about as bad as it can probably get, like most of you. My company was sold to Land Securities just for Christmas, which is one of the largest property companies in Britain. It's chaired by a woman. Two of the three executive members of the board are female. And across the board of that company, I think it is one person less than 50%. My company was delisted from the stock market to be acquired by Landsec, and we had 50-50 representation on our board. And at the bottom of the rung in our company, we have a very good representation between men and women, but it's that chunky bit in the middle where the problem sits, because it I'm going to say it's quite easy to put a picture in your annual report of 8 people on a board and make half of them be women and half of them be men. That's quite easy. When you've got 400 people in that bulge in the middle, you've got to work an awful lot harder to make that work. And so how it happened in terms of our company delisting from the stock exchange and our board being made redundant, the next layer down that I sat on at that point is all men, which would then suddenly became very evident and apparent and shocking. And so our finance director decided at that time that he was going to leave. And so I sat in the board. I'm going to tell you the story. I probably shouldn't. I know we might get slapped on the wrist tomorrow morning, but I'm going to tell you. We sat in a board meeting and I said, when it came to turn for me to speak, that there was absolutely no way that we couldn't put a woman in that role. And through the recruitment process. And I was shocked at the gale of response back just to that comment about the fact that we needed to work hard to make sure that we it took the opportunity to increase by one person the representation on our board. And it wasn't just men who complained at me either about it. And I was shocked at the immediate knee-jerk reaction to the fact that that would mean that we were going to put somebody, if we put a woman in that role, it would probably mean that that wasn't the best candidate and that there was a positive discrimination, and that would mean that we, you know, had to compromise in some way. And I paused in response to that, because I couldn't quite believe what I was hearing. And then I realized that there was no understanding that it wasn't about just going out and finding somebody to do the job. It was about working harder. And so where I want to get to, and just at the sort of end of my comments, is that I think all of this boils down to personal responsibility for everybody in every company, particularly those of us who have senior roles. It's my job, in my wider job in our company, to encourage our senior team to do better in their jobs. So I hold part of the training portfolio, I hold the values portfolio, and the greatest tool that I want people to brandish in doing their jobs better is to feel some personal responsibility. I think that we can only be better property developers if we personally decide that we're going to come to work tomorrow morning with a personal ambition to make the places we build a bit better. We can't rely on rules and policies and groups of people in a company. We just have to decide it's me, you know, I'm going to do better. And I think in this issue, it is also about that. So it's about people with responsibility for recruitment, getting a shortlist back from a recruitment consultant with 6 men and 2 women, and sending it back and saying, not good enough. Because you have to say, seriously, are you telling me that there are twice as many, 3 times as many perfectly qualified men as there are women to do that job? I simply don't believe it. And if they say, well, you know, only men applied. So, well, go away and go and find them and work harder. And I think that in the end, it just comes down to a very, very personal desire to make a change and to go and work a little bit harder to make that change happen. The last thing I wanted to say is that my company is about, we're regeneration developers. So we are taking typically dead, undeveloped post-industrial land and turning it into, over time, parts of cities. And every use you could imagine is typically in our schemes. And so we are, by definition, making diverse places across all of the definitions of diversity. And what's driving us in that is, and what's driving us to make change inside our company, and we're not there yet, is an understanding that we cannot possibly make good diverse places if we are not diverse ourselves. So the first thing we have to do is look in the mirror and understand that if we have young and old and gay and straight, men, women, and somebody from every ethnic background that we can possibly imagine, because in the cities where we work, that is what life is like in our country, thank heaven. And so I feel like it's hard work, but it's quite simple hard work. You know, we just have to look in the mirror and understand that if we want to make good places, we have to see reflected back a version of those places in our own office. And that just for me sets a brief and a blueprint. And then we all have to take personal responsibility for going and making it so.
Thank you, Martin. Very, very provocative. Great. So we move on to Sasha.
Thank you. Sorry. Oh, thank you, Caroline. And thanks for the opportunity to be here. It's super exciting. My heart is going like that. Yes. So if I fluff my words, forgive me. I've been listening to what the panel was saying, and I can live with every word. And I just want to go back to about 25 years ago when I arrived here to work as an engineer. I'm a building services engineer, by the way, people. And when I came to work, I'm from Serbia, slightly more parity in engineering profession. I came here, and I didn't know it wasn't normal for females to be engineers. And then I got every meeting I went to, I was asked, why are you a building services engineer? And I was like, because I like engineering. So there's this massive expectations that females would do certain jobs and males would do other jobs. And that kind of hadn't moved on very much in some respects, but we're doing well. But being a female in construction industry and therefore slightly unusual has its unexpected benefits. So when I was this gobby little Eastern European engineer who was a female, I kept getting sent to all these conferences about natural ventilation, about heat pumps, about low energy stuff, you know, and look what happened. Because the boys wanted to do the big, you know, chunky machines that guzzled a lot of stuff. So I, good for us. And over time, I leaned towards it. I became this low energy. I do low energy buildings. And I was listening to what Selena said. And you said, if you want to make a difference to the world, be a client. I agree with that. But if you want to make a difference to your own quality of life, I'm sorry to everyone here, do your own practice. So after about 20 odd years in various corporates, I started my own practice, M-Step, most of whom are here, who happen to be mainly females. Not because we looked for females, but because it's representation. People see what they could perhaps become or what they would like to become. And it grows by osmosis, if you like. And one of the benefits of being an own person in their own practice is my time is much more my own. And I'm a fairly active member of Equilibrium, but also I've spent quite a bit of time in Diversity, which is a wonderful project. It's a pan-European project spearheaded by Daniela that encompasses partners from 26 places, super talented people and clever people, some of which are in this room, data scientists, health professionals, university people, teachers, construction people. And we all sat around the table and trying to figure out how to make the environment work for everybody. Because on a very simple level, a grown-up, a fully grown adult, and a small child do not breathe the same air. It's different. And therefore, we need to make our environment work for all of us. People in poorer housing near busy motorways do not breathe the same quality air as people near parks, who live near parks. So there's a social element to it. There's an element of age. Pensioners do not move around very much. If they live in good housing in a nice area, good for them. They breathe good air, but if they don't, they breathe very poor quality air. And it's not just about air, but it's about all of us working together to make the environment work for each and every of those different groups that live in the cities. And I'm going to do another plug. Daniela, thank you for pushing it this way, for this wonderful book called Invisible Women. And it's all about data bias in collection of data. Because I thought I knew stuff. I thought I knew that most of the world is built essentially on a template of a 27-year-old white male. Seat belts in cars, heart medicine, anesthesia, all this stuff are measured to a certain weight and a certain fitness that is generally not most of the population. And then I read this and I was shocked. And it's a little bit about those journeys, how male, and it's, look, this wasn't a planned thing. It wasn't a bunch of males said, we're going to screw everybody else over. just the fact that the people around the table who were deciding about these things historically were men, and there was no representation of other groups. And now, for the first time in history, we have an opportunity for all of us, and in the great, through great projects such as diversity, to sit around the table and talk about the stuff that we want seen in our cities, that we want represented, whether we want more cars or less cars or more walking paths or more pusher buggies or carry the shopping. We all need to say, what is it that makes our lives work better? If we don't, this is my favorite prop. It's got nothing to do with Roe versus Wade, although we talk about that a lot, but not now. This is a standard issue coat hanger. Now, I don't iron. I drip and dry my clothes. I wash and drip, right? Every time I put anything on this, it grows horns. And I'm pretty wide-shouldered, right? So this is not made for female size. But because it was easier and cheaper to manufacture one size fits all, it doesn't fit half of the world's population. Coat hanger. Now imagine that extrapolated to the chairs, to the size of doors, to the size of steps. And then think about people who are not as mobile. Think about little kids. Think about people who are older or have a different way of going about things. All of that we need to take into account when we're designing our cities. And I think then we'll have cities that are fit for all. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you all so much. And I hope that's piqued your interest in contributing to the conversation. Magali has a what are these things called?
Microphone.
That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you. Has a microphone. So put your hand up and let's have some conversation going. I'm going to just start by highlighting some of the things that I think came out of what people have been talking about just now. One, measuring things is really important. If you don't measure it, you can't value it. You don't know whether it's good or bad. So measuring. Personal responsibility. And I think that resonates so well with what we talk about in EQN. We want people to be influential. Everybody who is involved in EQN is influential, whether they are a leader of an organization or a junior person in the organization. If they go into their daily work feeling influential or wanting to be influential, then change will happen. The idea that what we do, and we have a huge responsibility within our industry to reflect society and to build places that are valuable for women, 51% of the population, by the way, but also for other groups. And if you work a city to work for women, then it will work for most other people as well. Creating role models, being role models, that's another thing to think about. So over to you. Who's going to kick off the conversation? Your go. Thank you, Laura.
Hi, I'm Laura Kidd. I'm head of architecture at HS2. And this one's for Selena. You talk about the client and the client. How, in your opinion, can a client really make a difference? I mean, when I first became a client, it was quite daunting, because all of a sudden you have this terrible responsibility and no money, I hasten to add, to actually try and make a difference. And you go about it in a way that you hope will make a difference. But I just wondered, from the perspective of other people in the room, how can I, as a client, really make a difference? I do try, and I can give you some examples, but that's not what I want to know. I want to know from you lot what we as clients can be doing better.
That's a good question, Laura. Brilliant. For me, I think, actually reflecting on what Martin's talking about, I think in the end, it does come down to personal responsibility. I think the opportunity to kind of use your own instincts and vision to make a difference around the table. And it might be a conversation about, I mean, you're involved in conversations about pretty significant pieces of infrastructure, but it could be something about, literally about a threshold between a building and public space and how you can make something feel better for those that are using it. I always say to people I work with, you have to trust your own instincts in the end. And if you don't know, talk to people about it, get be aware as a client. I think that's probably in the end one of the most important things, is to never get into a sort of tunnel vision. And it is very easy, I know, and you probably have this experience all the time, I certainly do, it's very easy to get into that kind of narrow perspective of not having enough money for these aspirations, trying to work through all the detail, struggling with a design team that just will not do what they're told. And, you know, wanting to push you as hard as you can. And it's kind of, it's you have to kind of, in the end, use judgment and your own knowledge of the world that you occupy and a willingness to engage with it. You know, it's not enough just to stick to the rules. And sometimes you do have to go back to your seniors and say, this is where we've got to, and I'm really pushing for this thing to happen. And it's I'm doing this because it's important, and it's important for these reasons, you know. And I think it does come back to, I think it does come down to personal, your own kind of personal responsibility and agency in the end. That's what I think.
I think as a client, and particularly you know, you're a very big client. You have absolute control to set the tone of the work that you commission. I've just spent the last 2 days listening to pitches from architects, a couple of whom are in the room tonight.
Hello.
And part of our brief, we were able to say, was that you had to field a diverse team. Because in the same way that I said, I want my company to look in the mirror and feel that we reflect what the places that we've been. The teams of people that I've been talking to in the last couple of days are going to create that place that we are going to build, and I want them to be as diverse as those places too. And so it's about whatever little bit you can do every day to make it the norm that who sits in a room is a diverse team thinking about a diverse community and diverse places. Because one day, we're not going to have to engineer it. It's just going to happen. And we have the power as clients to demand it in the short term.
I suppose the only thing I'd say to that is that the great thing about my role is it's not just architecture, it's inclusive design as well.
Yes,
exactly. It comes under my umbrella. And it's wonderful. The best thing about HS2 is be able to do research in areas whereby nobody else has got the time or the money. So, you know, we've done a lovely piece of work on looking at disabled toilets and what an enhanced disabled toilet would look like to cope with all of the needs of the people, not just, you know, what they are in the BS. And that's now been looked at by TfL and Network Rail and others. So it's kind of like you can really hit the boundaries. But I suppose the thing is, it's kind of like, and you're right about influencing within your company, making sure, trying to press to make sure you get equal opportunity at interviews and within your team and those sorts of things. And you can do all of those things, but it's kind of like, how can I really help not just the things that I can influence, but what other things could I influence? Do you know, it's kind of like, I can see what I can influence and I can work on that. But what other opportunities might there be? Because as you say, I'm in a position whereby I meet a lot of people and I work with a lot of people. So is there something else that we as clients should be doing, really, is what I'm asking.
I think you can commission research. I think you can answer Caroline's point about measuring, finding out what the problem is. Problems that you don't even know that they exist.
Can I add to this?
I think there are, in a way, three things that I would comment on. Firstly, is I think clients are hugely, hugely influential and hugely powerful. And I think a lot of clients don't realize that. But certainly, you know, the professions have been talking for ages about, oh yeah, we're going to become more 50-50, et cetera, et cetera. Has it happened? I've been in the business 35, 40 years. No, it hasn't really. What has happened in most recent years is that clients have started to actually sit there and say, I'm sorry, there's 5 white men in front of me. That's not good enough. And what has been the result of that is that those five white men have gone back to their organizations and gone, oh shit, we're not going to get those fantastic projects which we thought were ours because we're fielding five white men. So the power of the client has actually started to instigate change within the professions. So that's the first thing, is influencing on a people level. The second thing I think absolutely is research, and having the budgets to do the kind of research which enable those, the more diverse, the more useful things to happen in the world is critical and is a responsibility, I think, of anyone who has a big budget. And we know that a lot of the larger architectural and design companies also do that kind of research. So I think that's a responsibility for people with budget. And the third thing is actually in the projects we design and making sure that the actual product that we're designing has some sort of focus to it, which is diverse. That would be my sense, those three things: people, project, and research.
Carolyn, can I piggyback on that? Because something that you said resonates, and I think it goes back to what Caroline and Martin said about the research. In diversity, there is 26 partners, about 130 people. We've been talking for 6 months to find out what is it that we don't know. Known knowns are fairly straightforward. We know what the quality of air, how we collect data, but we don't know which data we don't know that we need to collect. And that in therein lies the rub, I think. And I think forums like this and beyond are all about sharing that bit of information, saying, look, we've talked for 6 months and we discovered that if you want to know something about African immigrants in Spain, you need to go to Moroccan restaurants on the South Coast. Mm-hmm. And we all like, wow, okay, well, that makes sense. Nobody of us thought about anything like that. So it needs that whole diversity. It needs a reason. But I don't think that any single institution can do that on their own. Because like I said, there's this massive European project that we, all of us are a part of, and we're still in the finding out process. But communication, forums, networking, I think is really, really important, because that's where we share.
Daniela, would you like to, you'll need the
speech. I was just going to.
Okay, right. Sorry.
Because I was sitting here holding all and right. It's a long way over there. Kirsten Leeds from Grimshaw, glad to be here. Fantastic points. I just want to build, you know, really welcome the provocation. You need to become a client. You need to become, you know, a business owner. We've all got influence. And, you know, just building on the point that Martin's made about what are the barriers to us all being able to shape. I mean, we're all at different stages of our careers. How do we all take our own power of influence at every stage and every field that you work in? You know, we don't all need to be moving up to this wonderful position before you can have an influence. And it's actually, what are the barriers, do we think, that's stopping that happening? Because, you know, we've been talking about this issue for a very long time and it's not changing really that dramatically over 30, 50 years. So it's, I'm asking the panel.
Does anyone in the audience want to pick up on what Kirsten has just said, or indeed what Laura was saying? Yeah, we have.
Terry Okoro, one of the things we haven't mentioned today is culture. And culture is really important, the culture of the organization. Do you feel safe enough to speak up? Because sometimes we want to speak up, but there's not that psychological safety, which means that you hold it back because you don't want to be the one who is always raising the issues. And until we deal with that issue where people feel that it's safe to speak up, people just wouldn't speak up. There are one or two points I wanted to come back on. One of them was to do with the myth about, you know, if you're wanting to appoint a more diverse candidate, that you're lowering the standards. I think we need to debunk a lot of these myths around diversity and inclusion. I wrote a blog last week about that, and that was one of the issues, you know, I raised. And the fact that, no, you're not reducing standards, you're broadening your search, you're broadening the criteria, because sometimes the criteria is too limited because it's trying to get the typical man who's always been in that position. So that's really quite important. And then the third point I'd like to make is regarding how do we get more inclusion? If we're trying to do it individually, yes, we can make progress, but I think it's great if organizations and clients have an inclusive strategy and vision that everyone is working to. Then you can sort of put your finger, have you complied with that element? If we're trying to raise it later in the project, it's more difficult to achieve it if it's not part of the original strategy. Thank you.
Excellent.
Hello, I'm Christina Norton from Soundings. I'm an architect, but I've dedicated my career to establishing a company that focuses on public consultation and engagement. And I guess my question here is, we are talking a lot about our practices, but we're not talking about the people. We're talking about us, but actually the people who make cities are not us, they're the people out there. So for me, it is about how we get clients and local authorities and investors to invest in communities and to understand that that is a hugely challenging project, to be inclusive, to reflect the diversity that you find in cities takes a lot of effort. And I would say that clients like Lendlease put a lot of effort into that, but still, are we listening to those people? Does it actually make any difference, or do we just carry on making cities the way we feel they should be made? So are we listening enough to the women out there, the diverse communities, the whole range of people that you've been talking about in terms of inclusive design? And I love the idea of going to the Mexican bar, because that's what we do. We spend our time finding people and going to speak to them. Sorry about that. So that's my, I guess, provocation for this group today.
Are we able to respond to any?
Yes, please.
I just wanted to firstly pick up, I think the point about culture is brilliant, actually. I think I was wondering when you were sort of saying it, the way the conversation was going, I was saying, what's actually stopping people calling this out? Why do you feel so, you know, you can't say it's unacceptable or there has to, you know, this is an issue, it's so obvious an issue, you need to take more action. I think actually the kinds of points you're talking about in terms of culture are really important. And I'm trying to think about what has changed. I think within the period of time I've been in my organization, it has changed. And I do think actually things like you're saying about actually having an active strategy around that, making it really, having measures on your scorecard, you know, really explicit statements that you're not going to accept non-diverse panels, you're not going to accept things. That all feels very formulaic at the time, but actually they're really important bits of architecture that then give you the opportunity to speak out and sort of say, actually, no, this isn't right. And once one voice starts doing it, you can start building on that and creating that safe space. I think that culture is hugely important. I actually think it extends to what your expectations are for involving communities as well, actually, because once you've said that and you start saying that's the kind of organization you want, because, you know, if I think about my organization, it's a public sector organization. It's got to represent the city it serves. And therefore the projects we deliver have to represent the city we serve. So, you know, what kind of engagement are you in? What kind of metrics, again, are you using to measure the outcomes from that kind of engagement? And once you start putting a diversity lens on, you do start getting really different answers to what the projects should be.
Fiona, please.
My name is Fiona Strelitz, and I founded and run a user research consultancy called ZZA. And I'd like to make two points. The one is that I think that we talk in two blanket terms about diversity. I think that diversity isn't the same across all the different demographic subsets. And so for me, the difference between white male middle class and white female middle class in my masses and masses of empirical research is not great at all. But Sasha's point about, you know, your Moroccan restaurant worker touches something significant. And what I have found is that when you look at the discrepancy between highly paid, well-educated people and poorly paid, maybe economically inactive people, you get huge differences. And I'm conscious from a recent study I've done, which is in a workplace environment where across a very representative sample of roles, the ability to engage in the same narrative was very different according to people's education levels. It was very conspicuous. So that's the first point. I think we do need more specificity. And my second point is about diversity in the design process, which I think is where we have so much complacency and constipation of thought. So I'd like to share one example just as a practical unlocking. I happen to do a lot of post-occupancy evaluations of police stations. The reason that I got into it is inadvertent. And when I did my fourth study for the Met Police, I came to a police station that had a big skylight over the custody desk. Now, custody environment's very high pressure. It's very stressful for the people who work there. It's very stressful for any of us if we're detained. And this, I came to this environment where you could suddenly see the sky and the weather. And I called the client and I said, how come this is that the last three of your buildings I've seen were totally sealed hermetic environments, and this has this external aspect? And he said, when I got your first report, I suddenly thought, why do we have custody suites like that? Why don't we change the brief? And there was time to change the brief for this building, which was further on in the supply chain. And so it's a little example of unlocking, whether we men or women, or, you know, we just tend to get stuck in the same kind of lift and shift with very little critical interrogation about whether more needs could be better fulfilled across the spectrum if we just engage in critical reimagination.
Okay, so, that's so fascinating about the police stations. I'm so with you on that one. I think there are two or three things that have happened that brought conversations together, particularly Terry, your point. As well as personal responsibility, I think if you are anxious about stepping up and speaking up, because, you know, and I thought exactly that when you said that you were an antagonist in your business, you know, and I assumed that the seniority of your role probably supports you being an antagonist. And if you were not so senior in your role, you might not have said that.
Yeah.
Is about leveraging other things than personal interest. So when I made a presentation to my board colleagues a year or so ago about an update to our sustainability strategy, I put a slide in about the increase in demands that were being made on us by our customers to deliver on that agenda. And I just sort of stuck it in because, you know, it was just an interesting new bit of information that had been flying around, new data that had been flying around. I tell you, they all sat up, ramrod straight, their backs got straight, because they heard something that meant their bank balance was in jeopardy. The tenants, the planners, the investors, all of those people who permit us to do our business and permit us to make a profit were telling us we needed to behave in a better way. And I think that's true of this issue too. You know, I think white middle-aged men are on the run. And I think that there is a foot in the door. The famous finance director in my company who left his business, I was having a chat with him on the day before he left. And I said, what are you going to do? And he said, I quite fancy a bit of a portfolio career. And I said, what have you done about that? He said, I went to talk to a recruitment consultant. And, you know, she wasn't very hopeful for me. And I said, do you not understand why? You know, because you're just not the right look for what people want to put on their boards, you know. And he said, well, that's not fair. And I said, it's not your turn. Like, it really isn't. And I watched his face sort of crumple because he realized that that was true, that he was not going to have a good time sitting in offices with recruitment consultants trying to get a seat on a board as a non-exec or as a trustee of a charity, because there were plenty of other people who did not look like him closer to the front of the queue. And that was a very interesting conversation for me in that regard, because I just thought, God, that is... And if you can tie that sort of conversation to customers' buying power, mm-hmm. and I think that you have a particularly useful thing that, you know, I love this. This is a fantastic example. HS2 is going to produce hundreds of these, yeah. unless you recognize that you have an enormous power for it not to, in terms of stairs and steps and seats and doors and lights and skylights and endless. And I think you're really powerful. I think you can make a difference, make a real big difference.
No pressure.
Can I also just add something about psychological safety, actually, because it's a really, really important point, I think. And I, you know, reflecting also Ziona's point about kind of being more critical and understanding things from a research perspective and sort of a kind of genuine critical understanding of what we've done before. The part of our business in Lendlease that is not at all diverse is, of course, construction, where all efforts over the last 20 years have not been that successful. And there are nowhere near enough women or diversity at all in that part of the business. And the other thing that Lendlease has always been known for as well is health and safety and sort of improving the improving outcomes for its employees, particularly on construction sites. So, you know, 20 years ago, we started injury and incident free, which was all about owning personal safety. And then we went to global minimum requirements 10 years ago. And that was all about kind of just establishing a sort of benchmark across all of our environments about what standards we should achieve in terms of health and safety. And our results have changed radically as a result of that. We thankfully don't cause injuries to too many people, but it's still not good enough. So the question is, well, what next? And looking at research on our construction sites, which are dominated by men, the next phase, we think, is going to be about psychological safety. It is going to be about creating an environment within which those men who are on site are able to speak up and talk about their experiences. Because at the moment, the impact of not having a diverse workforce is actually incredibly negative for them. It's a kind of this sort of... I would say, I hesitate to say toxic masculinity in this context, but yeah, I mean, a working environment on a construction site is not that conducive to the kind of open and it's not an open environment within which you can express concerns and anxieties about your safety, whether it's mental safety or physical safety or any other. And so creating an environment within which you feel capable, you feel able to step forward and talk to people about how you feel, is the next challenge for us. And I think probably one of the things that we can do to help make that work better is to focus on diversity, because I think a more diverse workforce on a construction site will make a big difference to the experience there. But it's really interesting about how this isn't something which impacts just how do we get, you know, not from our perspective of women and diversity, but actually the counteract to that, where there isn't sufficient, I think is equally problematic.
There's a gentleman at the back there who would like to say something.
Thank you very much. My name is Aidan Potter from JMP Architects. Amazing conversation, very thought-provoking comments. And I was thinking throughout it of kind of role models in terms of profoundly influential women in city making. And I found two polarities, and I just wanted to talk to you about them. On the one hand, a kind of comfortable polarity, comfortable role model, I guess, would be Jane Jacobs, the extraordinary American urbanist. And many of you obviously seen the recent David Hare play with head-to-head with Robert Moses. And, you know, Jacob's brilliant expression and insistence on the collective and the value of existing relationships and communities, so profound and so influential. But then there's another role model, and it's a more difficult role model, but equally influential in actually strategic approach to our cities, and that's Margaret Thatcher. And that's a very difficult, it's a difficult role model, a profoundly influential and practical politician who changed and casts a long shadow in terms of political attitudes towards community. And I'm not making any judgments about either or all of them. I just wondered if this issue of, or just would, I'd love to hear comments about these two role models and whether or not there's a kind of Thatcher syndrome, just as a question, that somebody who is so determined, so ferociously ambitious, had to work so hard to get to the top, that actually, do you think there's a danger? Is there ever a danger? Is it even reasonable to ask if it's a danger? That there's a point where maybe that kind of determination to kind of rise in the man's world, which she did so extraordinarily, she actually lost, and you can lose perhaps that ability to be the Jane Jacobs, to the more collective, consultative, diverse attitude towards collaboration. I couldn't figure it out myself.
Tricky.
I
feel like Margaret Thatcher was driven by political ideology rather than gender. Mm. I almost think the fact of her womanhood was incidental to her profoundly anti-community ideology, and you know, the sort of the what we now I suppose look on as quite kind of like 1980s sort of, you know, self first, nothing about communities, it's about personal wealth and personal success. And I don't know, maybe that's because I'm a woman and I'm you don't want us all being tarred with, you know, the idea that if you're ambitious, you know, you cannot have empathy for other people.
But
exactly.
But conversely,
that's my view.
Can I just say that the great sadness is that those two people who happen to be women are even today being talked about because they are women. Or in with women being the thing, you wouldn't be saying, well, you know, Adolf Hitler had a particular approach because he was a man. Or maybe today you might, but certainly that wasn't the way things were. He's not being described as being the way he was because he was male. And I think that that's actually the important point here, is that Thatcher was Thatcher. She happened to be a woman, but Thatcher was not the way she was simply because she was a woman. And similarly, Jane Jacobs, the same, I don't know.
Except her experience was profoundly driven in the 50s from the fact that she was a woman and a housewife with children. And she observed that the women who were at home being then housewives because their husbands were the people who were out at work, were the people who were policing the streets and watching out from their kitchen windows where they were doing the washing up over their children. And her Eyes on the Street thesis came from the way that the society in the place where she lived worked, that was particularly driven by women who were at home being housewives in the 1950s. So conversely to the Thatcher example, and I think you're absolutely right, it came particularly because she was a woman and reflected women's role in communities at that time.
I think the only thing I'd sort of say is, I think there's a danger, you think, you have to be a hero. It's like the point of this conversation is that it should just be completely the norm that women are half of whatever decision-making forum is going on. So you don't have to have an extreme point of view. You don't have to be particularly special. Actually, you just have to be good at your job. And you will naturally see, and you raised a very good point about diversity being many, many things. But the whole point about diversity, whatever its gender, other, is that different people see the world differently. So it's not about having North Stars left and right and saying they have a particularly dominating view. we need to create decision-making structures which are more reflective of the society we live in, and then we'll get solutions and outcomes which deliver a wider range of benefits. So for me, I think it's interesting to reflect on that, but I'm looking more at the barriers that stop normal people getting into these roles, because we're all normal actually, and actually just want to be able to have a normal opportunity to make a difference.
Can I add to that conversation?
Well, I don't think we should. I mean, we talked a lot about whether you have positive promotions for people depending on gender, and whether, you know, how you really understand the impact of women in decision making. I think the issue is that's because we're on a transition. I don't think I'm particularly exceptional in any way. I happen to follow a particular career path, and I wouldn't want anyone here who's on their career journey to think, gosh, I have to be Jane Jacobs, or I have to be Margaret Thatcher, or I have to be something particularly special. I think just have the opportunities depending on how well you do your job.
I just wanted to add to the comment as well, because I thought it was really interesting that the point that you raised about, you know, Margaret Thatcher and her strength and being a sort of superwoman. The point of this event today and all of these kind of diversity events is that, you know, we are addressing an issue that is a barrier in our industry where people can't just be free to be who they want to be. You know, when we're all children, we have aspirations as to what we want to be. But then as you're going through that journey, that's when the barriers start to be introduced. And so what we're trying to do now is introduce measures where we can dismantle those barriers and then just allow people just to, you know, forget that they're a woman, forget that they're a man, forget that, you know, they're Black or that they're white. They just want to enjoy their life and enjoy their work and get on with it. So the quicker we can dismantle these barriers, you know, there's women, strong women, women who are more gentle, you know, lots of different personalities across the spectrum, and you're always going to find that. So I think it's generally, we just want to dismantle these very visible barriers so that we can just start to enjoy our lives.
Well said. Would you like to pass to the lady in front of you? Do you want to put your hand up again? Yeah. Getting there.
Yeah,
you're fine.
Hello. I don't know how to articulate this kind of thinking, but I think seeking the big thinker is not the right way to think about the city nowadays. Even though Jane Jacobs did a really great work at that point, but now we are talking about the city with ordinary people and then city for everyone. And then to change the city for everyone is, to do that, I think what we need is the decentralization. We are not taking over the men's place, I think. Even if we take the men's place, as one of the audience said, we need to take over the well-educated white woman. And then I think what we are talking about city nowadays is everyone can enjoy the city as themselves, and then being honest as themselves. We don't need to pretend we are the mayor or a powerful woman or poker people and then good English speaker, let's say, and then everyone can do that. And I think the finding the role model or big thinker is not something our task in nowadays. Yeah, so that's my thinking. Yeah,
I think that's absolutely right. And actually it reflects a little bit of what Christine was saying about community and talk and listening and getting input from people in an active way that does shape the city and shares that shaping with everybody. You know, and I think that's one of our biggest dilemmas as a large scale client, is that you're dealing with a really significant area, a lot of investment going in at the top, a really top down kind of structure. And how do you actually create a process that genuinely does properly involve everybody and properly reflects what their desires are and what their needs are in an urban environment? And I think that's challenging. And it's, you know, we are very much on a journey there, and it's, you know, we're working really hard with Christina and others to talk to people around, particularly Euston at the moment, to understand all that. And yeah, long way to go, but I think that's absolutely right. This is where we need to aspire to get to.
You know, I'm hoping it's going to go the way of environmental social governance, because you mentioned big money moving around and stuff follows big money. So, you know, 2 years ago, ESG, I was, you know, Google it, it's something like extra special great. Now you Google ESG and there's 700 million consultancies who are providing advice on it, because the big money moved. And there is a sense that the big money has now realized that 50% of this world is 51 is female. Within those layers, there are people with different social standing, economic standing, culture, and so on. And those are all consumers. And we want them to be healthy and happy so they can consume more. I'm being only slightly cynical, but I'm hoping there's a sense of this movement, and this is why we're all talking more and more, of recognition of the value of diversity, and that we're all going to get there.
Yeah, thank you. I also wanted to add to this conversation, as an architect working in the field more than 20 years now, I'm so happy to be discussing these issues and being a part of the change. Recently, we can also say that I like this idea of normal people. When we are discussing women in city making, we're not only discussing the way women are there, but also the way women behave, because sometimes women are expected to be dominant, and they are expected sometimes to be carrying on with what we all learned to be belonging to men, that they, these ideas, but the idea of normal people with our old vulnerabilities and other cultural codes that are embedded in us, we can really be active and be a change maker in this society as designers. And I really appreciate this idea. And
yes. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Said. Would you like to pass the microphone to the end? No, yeah.
You're going to go to the microphone
rather than the other way around.
Okay. Thank you. Hello. I'm not sure I have the vocabulary to express this, so I apologize in advance if it's a clumsy question. But I'd like to ask a question about the public sector's role in all of this. And Selena and Martin have perhaps a little bit more flexibility in how they go about appointing designers and design teams compared to those that are within the public sector and subject to all the sort of procurement rules and that sort of stuff. I think that, you know, there's been a very healthy move in recent years about requiring diversity within design teams and making that a mandatory part of an appointment. But it's not enough, because really what we're doing, it's returning to sort of the Margaret Thatcher point, I think, a little bit, that it's about appointing people because who they are, and visibility is a good thing. But what the questions we should be asking are not, have you got a team that comprises people of color or people who are disabled or women or whatever form of diversity it is, but what is the influence that they are going to have on the project? And we're very, very, and the public sector is very poor at this, at asking the wrong questions. Simply saying that you need to have a team that's diverse is not good enough. What the questions need to be reframed, and asking the questions, asking what influence is that going to have on the city and, well, the scheme or whatever it is that results from that. And so how do we shift this culture to make sure that we're asking much more profound questions and making sure that we achieve more diversity within city making?
Can I just respond to that with one thing that I know in running lots of competitions that even within public sector procurement, you can word it in such a way that you encourage diverse teams to come to the table. But you have a really good point about how do you then make sure that that actually results in something which is effective? And I think there's quite a lot of cynicism that goes on at the moment where you have some of the big design companies that bring along a whole load of little diverse companies, which they add the sparkle and the stardust to the proposition they put forward. And then that falls away once they won the project. I think we go back to the whole thing which we've talked about already about power and money. And one of the things which we've certainly done in some of the competitions I've run with Selena and with others, in doing the procurement, you find out where the fees are going to be allocated within that team. And you work out and you specifically say that you want the money to be divided in a way that enables the people who are bringing diversity to the table to have power within the team which is put forward. I think that's one thing that's worth thinking about, because I think money equals power. So if you find out where the money's going within the team, then you can start to work something out. But I don't know whether others would like to comment on that as well.
Well, the only thing I would sort of say is, I think obviously as a public sector organization, you are subject to clear obligations to deliver good outcomes that are, equal, diverse. So I can see that there's, I think we're probably as subject as others to being wooed by the right sort of group of people turning up. But if you're really, really clear on your requirements and the kinds of outcomes that you want, i.e. that it has to actually serve those kind of audiences and meet those, actually really perform in terms of the kind of diverse audience that we need to relate to, then the people that almost forces that question, because it's up to you guys to decide how you provide that, as long as I'm really clear on the requirements that I want at the end.
Martin, did you want to?
Yeah, it's slightly tangential, but I've been writing a column for BD every month for the last 6 years, 8 years, golly. Yeah. So I've written 96 columns. And when I started writing that column, they asked me as a developer to write a column that would help architects to get better work or to understand better how to deal with their clients. And I've noticed, not by design, but by my responding to how I think about my business over those years, that I've changed the way that I write about what architects can do for developers, to be much more about how developers desperately need their architects, who I think are much more connected in the world to how the world is and how the world needs to be, to help us poor developers to understand how better to make places, which is as it should be. And that's really interesting for me to sort of understand that. And so I think it goes counter to the point about clients being so powerful and to make change, saying that as the market demands change, people like me flail around looking for people who know the answers to help us to make things better. And that's when architects and consultants and people like you hold the power, because you have the answers. You are capable of having the answers and capable of being being listened to. And I think that that's very different than it was not that long ago.
I'm conscious that it's 8 o'clock. We've got one more hour, but I know we have a lady here who'd love to ask a question. So let's make that the last contribution.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, it's a comment really based on a few of the latest questions, but I was just going back to kind of what Sasha was saying about where finance is being directed in ESG. And I think that really, and I wonder what you think, you know, I think this comes down to transparency and data. And I've had some conversations earlier this evening with some ladies who are working on the diversity projects. And I think that really, yeah, transparency and data is the key to unlocking how we reflect what's needed in the work that we do. And as the lady from CZA said, diversity is complex, and it's what we might call a wicked problem, where the driving factors are varied and multiple within themselves. So, I mean, going back to what we were talking about ESG, I don't think that ESG is a perfect science. Sorry, I failed to introduce myself. I'm Emily Day from Bureau Happold, and I've been working in ESG for sort of 3 or 4 years now. But I would say that ESG is taking steps in the right direction because it's doing things like championing data. We talked about reporting gender pay gaps and gender diversity on boards and things. So I think that we should really be starting there and taking what we can from that principle and thinking, how can we push for better data on what matters? And it makes me wonder, how much data have we collected from successfully and inclusively designed built environments already? I don't know. I'm interested to know.
Not a lot.
Okay, I think we should have a drink and we should continue the conversation, please. As you have that drink, it leads for me to say a huge thank you to the four panelists for giving up their time and coming along and being provocative, and to all of you for contributing, and for, I can see lots of people sitting there. There's these kind of little cogs whirring away. I think it's been actually quite an interesting conversation. So thank you to everybody, and go and have a drink.